I have on the line with me this morning Dr. Bernie Siegel, who has written a book titled 101 Exercises for the Soul, a divine workout plan for body, mind, and spirit. And I guess sometimes we forget about the fact that we can work our mind and our spirit. Well, I'll take that back. I know we can work our, we know how we can work out our body. We can certainly work out our mind, as many are here at UCI in higher education. But how do we work out our spirit? And that is one point that I'm excited to hear about from Dr. Bernie Siegel this morning. I just want to mention some of his other books. All these titles sound interesting. Love, Medicine, and Miracles, Help Me to Heal, How to Live Between Office Visits, Peace, Love, and Healing, Prescriptions for Living, Smudge Bunny, and 365 Prescriptions for the Soul. And then before Dr. Bernie Siegel joins us, I just want to mention one accolade from Deepak Chopra, the author of the Book of Secrets. He says, I've always admired Dr. Bernie Siegel as one of the most remarkable minds of our time. He combines an analytical scientific mind with a deep knowingness of spirituality. His 101 exercises for the soul will help you understand and learn from that part of you, which is the ultimate and supreme genius and mirrors the wisdom of the universe. Wow, that's quite a compliment.
Pretty well said. And let me read you a sentence that was written over 2,300 years ago by Plato. And therefore, if the head and body are to be well, you must begin by curing the soul. That is the first thing. And it really struck me when I came across that, because I'm always saying that it's hard to have anything new to say when you look at, you know, who has preceded us in the last few thousand years. And I think what we're trying to do and what I'm constantly trying to do is make things practical for people. And so I call myself a coach, and many of the people who commented on this book use the word practical, so that if you read it, you get the message. You know what I mean? You can apply it to your life immediately and practically and not sit around wondering, what is this guy talking about? You know, what's the metaphor? What parable is he sharing with me? It is about my life and the experience I've had with people with life-threatening illness, really, to make your time here meaningful. And let me say that to me, the soul is what's going on within us at a deeper level. I don't like to use the word inferior, but it's like what's covered over. So you've got to dig down to get to it in terms of where it's in position. But so many of us stay in the superficial stuff, you know, in our heads, and what are you thinking, and what are other people thinking, and how do I look, and into all the material things. And again, you know, your mortality in a sense teaches you to pay attention to what's going on at a feeling level, at a soulful level. And when you start living that life, as one woman said, I reclaimed my life. And instead of dying, boom, she really had her disease disappear, because she'd got fed up with treatment and everything else and said, I reclaim my life. And that's what I try to help people do, reclaim their life.
And you've mentioned in the beginning, first of all, I love Plato and the idea that the soul is the place to start. And and from that springs forth the rest of our health. And you mentioned that our mind, we stay in that, at that place, or perhaps, you know, when we're working out at the gym, we're there at that place. But the feeling side of all of this isn't the soul itself either. Am I correct in saying that? Because we can also exist in just the realm of feeling, where we're not bringing all of these things together, our mind and
Have the wrong feelings. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, you
know,
you can?
In that sense, because it's part of what I get into in the book, too. It starts out with attitude is everything. So, because attitude leads you to action. So if you feel you're going to be dead in a week, you live a very different life. If you go home totally depressed and climb into bed, then if you say, I want to fight for my life. I mean, I have connections, relationships, reasons to be here. I'd call it survival behavior. So then you exceed expectations. And that's something people have to look at. So, you know, too often I get very upset with what is supposedly medical education, but it doesn't teach how to communicate with people. And so you can kill people with your words, too, because of how you make them feel. And I get into things like fear also, because what happens in your body, a geneticist named Bruce Lipton talked about living in protection or in growth. So if you're in fear, you're in a protection place. Your immune system is not working well. What you're interested in is get blood, you know, to my heart and my extremities and let me get out of here. But, you know, when you're fearful of something that isn't a tiger or a poisonous snake, it doesn't help you to be in that protection phase because you really stop your immune function. You increase stress hormone levels and it has a deleterious effect on your body. But when you're into love, and humor and relationships, then you're in a growth phase. Then your immune function is wonderful. The stress hormone levels go down. You bond with people, and you're really growing and healing your body. And that's, again, you know, why I give people exercises so they can go out and experience these things or prescriptions. And believe me, I read my own books. I read the prescriptions at night and the exercises in the morning because I tend to write almost in a trance state. You know, all these thoughts come flowing out of me. So I get a kick out of reading what I've written, and then I really judge what I've written. You know, do I get something out of it? Then I say, you did a good job. But I find that there are certain days it's really boom, you know, like the light goes off and it helps me get through the day.
Well, then let's, if we can, touch on a few of your favorite exercises in this book. The title is There's 101, so we don't have time to go through all of them. Yet I think it would be helpful and meaningful for, you know, this is right. The holiday season and there's all kinds of things happening in people's lives. There's so many things happening in the world. There's, you know, we're so used to sound bites and moving so quickly on to the next thing. And as you said, when we're in a state of fear, It's at a cellular level. Even.
Well, one of the things, just as I was looking at it, like what to pick, was coming from your heart. And one of the things in that I read the other day that really helped me, exercise 27, starlight, candlelight, peace and reflection. To make a long story short, truthfully, as I wrote this, I mentioned my house is filled with electricians. You know, we're in the darkness. But at the bottom, it says, tonight, turn off the light, sit outside under the stars, bathe in the light of creation. If the weather has other ideas, sit quietly in the darkness of your home, light candles or a fire to warm you and restore your energy. And contemplate the ways you artificially create stress in your life and pledge to change those things. Just as you can restore light to your home by resetting the circuit breaker, you can restore it to your life by resetting your desires, expectations, and sense of gratitude. And that really helped me to reread that. And one other that I might...
Wait. Can we stay on this one for just a minute?
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Because this is so great. So the idea is to... because in our homes, especially these days, we have so many electronic gadgets on all the time. And so you're saying turn off all the lights, turn off everything.
Put a candle on or a fire in the fireplace and look, you know, at the natural light. Look at the stars. Look at the moon. We have a lot of pets, and I walk the dogs at night, and it's so wonderful when you can go out and don't even need a flashlight, you know, to walk outside in the street because the moon is shining, and it's such a soft, beautiful light, and the stars, and you can't help but feel better. I mean, right now we're having quite a snowfall, but again, the snow reflects the light and all the whiteness and the pureness, you know. And part of what I also share with people, you can go out and be miserable about, look at the weather and how am I going to travel. Or one of my other exercises is be an extraterrestrial. I mean, if this was your first day on the planet, step outside really with that thought in your mind. I have never been here before. And step out your door And you'll be amazed at how incredibly beautiful so many things are that you've never noticed before. You know, from tiny flowers to the rain or snow or, I mean, just everything gets to be fascinating. And, yeah, I do these things to keep myself focused and in a different place in life rather than getting upset and bitter and resentful about everything. It's take a look and enjoy it.
Wow. That's so meaningful, especially, gosh, here in Southern California, we're extremely lucky. We had a little bit of rain last night, but actually I noticed the moon last night was so beautiful. It was a half moon.
You know, I have to tell you, I laughed once. We were down in L.A., you know, having just flown out of Connecticut and glad to leave because of the snow and how terrible it was. When I get to L.A., I forgot the name of the mountain, but people were driving up the mountain to collect snow and put it on their cars and drive, you know, down again. And I told them, I'm happy to mail you some, you know. But again, it's, you know, they were taking time to do something because the snow meant something to them, you know, and brought something into their life. And rather than see it as a nuisance to you, it was beautiful and, you know, fit with the season.
Sure. Well, there's a phrase in here that I wonder if you could explain. It says, contemplate the ways you artificially create stress in your life and pledge to change those things.
Right. It's again, it's, you know, we talk about imagery. So if you picture the worst, which is what most people do, it could be, will I lose my job? Is that lump, you know, in my breast cancer? I just had a test. What's the result going to be? I mean, if you keep seeing everything as negative, think of what you're doing to yourself in your life. And on the other hand, if you change your image, you change yourself in your life. And I mean that literally. I mean, it's an example as a physician. If somebody said to me, I have to have surgery next week, and I said, draw a picture of yourself in the operating room, and it's a black box with nobody there taking care of you. And, yeah, they're going to have really a terrible experience there, including a lot of pain. Somebody else may draw it, being hugged by the surgeon, God and love, and it's just this beautiful scene. And I can tell you, they'll wake up and have minimal discomfort. And so, again, it's the image that we carry with us. And we're in charge. Well, the only thing I always say we're in control of are our thoughts. So you can change your thoughts. And my mother's message that I grew up with, which drove me nuts until I realized she was right, you see, you're worrying about something or something terrible happens. She would say, it was meant to be, God is redirecting you. Something good will come of this. And I really used to think as a kid that my mother just had no interest in my troubles, you know, that that was like her glib answer to everything. But I began to realize that many times something would go wrong in my life, and because of that, something good would happen later down the road. As a matter of fact, that book, Smudge Bunny for Children, was just voted by 10,000 children as a children's choice. What's the punchline in the book? Troubles can turn into blessings. See, that's the bunny's mother. And this is a true story where our neighbors discarded these bunnies, and my wife and I rescued them from the woods, and they became house bunnies. So, you see, you're thrown in the woods, your life is at stake, and what do? You end up in the living room of Bernie and Bobby Siegel. So, you know, they finish with, you know, Mom was right. And those are the things that when you are open to what could come of this rather than it'll be a disaster, you really change your life and how you live. See, the kids and animals understand that. They really don't. Well, somebody just did a study on children with cancer. And, you know, you go in and say to the kids, how you doing? They'd say, I'm okay, Mom. And he realized these kids are not worrying about, will I graduate? You know, will I get a degree? Will this happen? Will that happen? They're trying to have a nice day. Well, all the grown-ups are, you know, what's going to happen next month, next year, and torturing ourselves.
That is so true. My niece the other day brought a smile to my face because I was sitting there studying for finals this week, and, you know, she couldn't understand why I had to study for hours and hours and hours. She just couldn't get it. And I said, well, you will understand when you're in college.
Right.
And she said, what? She said, what, Auntie Sarah? That's in the future. I don't know if that's going to happen.
Right. And you know something, you know, I'm in New Haven, Connecticut, where Yale is, and we were doing a lot of surgery, and the, you know, students took care of them. And at exam time, yeah, you had more cases of appendicitis. So when you're under stress, And this is something, again, that years ago people got upset with me when I'd say, what's happening in your life? They'd say, oh, you're blaming me for getting sick. No, but you need to look at the events in your life that may make you vulnerable at this time in your life. You know, and that includes from appendicitis to cancer. I mean, what things are happening that may affect me? You know, I always, as an example, one recently, Christopher Reeve's wife developing cancer. And it's not blaming her to say, look what you went through with your husband becoming quadriplegic and dying, so that those emotional issues that she had to deal with in the last few years, yeah, can make her vulnerable now versus 10 years ago.
Yeah, since we're out of time, I think that that's such an important place to end. And I want to mention your book again, 101 Exercises for the Soul by Dr. Bernie S. Siegel. It's a divine workout plan for the body, mind, and spirit. Those out there that are asking themselves that question of, oh, did I cause myself what,
right.
Instead of looking at it in that way, you put it so eloquently.
In an empowering way.
Yes.
Right?
Can you
and let me say this.
That again.
I love what you just said. See, we're running out of time. And that's
sorry.
Why I like radio programs, so that every listener will understand that one day we all run out of time. So enjoy your lifetime.
Now.
Burn up, not out.
No, burn up, not out. That's good. Well, just please, I think internalizing that way to think about whatever our issues are, instead of blaming ourselves
mm-hmm.
for bringing this issue or this disease or whatever it is
right.
upon ourselves, how were we at a vulnerable place?
Well, you know, what it's about is parenting. I'm writing a book on parenting right now because I always call it the biggest public health issue I know of. If you grow up loved by your parents, you take care of yourself. I mean, I don't have time to go into all the statistics, but if you feel that your parents loved you, you have 1/4 the number of illnesses and problems that people who say my parents don't love me and didn't love me have. So I'd say reparent yourself, that you're a divine child, and get your baby pictures out and take a look at them, and you'll understand what I'm talking about.
Oh, well. Thank you very much for joining me this morning on Piece by Piece.
Bless you, Sarah. I mean, Sarah was my grandmother and others in the family, so I feel good talking to you.
I feel good talking to you, too, and I enjoy your book, and I hope those out there are inspired to take a look. I think there's an approach in it for everyone, and as you said, and as I read through the book, just the example you gave of just turning off the lights, such a simple,
yeah.
easy thing to do. We can all do that.
Yeah, and if you live in your heart, magic happens, so do that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Once again, this is Piece by Piece, and you're listening to KUCI in Irvine, 88.9 FM, also streaming live on the web at www.kuci.org. My guest on the line with me now is Christina Baldwin, who has written a book called Story Catcher, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story. And Christina Baldwin has taught seminars internationally for 30 years and has contributed 2 classic books, One to One, Self-Understanding Through Journal Writing and Life's Companion, Journal Writing as a Spiritual Quest to the Field of Personal Writing. She is also the author of New World Library's 7 Whispers, A Spiritual Practice for Times Like These. Christina is the co-founder of Peer Spirit Incorporated, an educational company devoted to building and sustaining a culture of conversation. Welcome to the show, Piece by Piece, Christina.
Thank you, Sarah.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And one of my favorite things to do is conversate.
Conversate. I like that. That's we like to play with language, you know.
I think language, I mean, I can clearly understand why, at least here at UCI, the field of linguistics is a difficult major to get into. It's fascinating. It's so meaningful and so nuanced, or it can be, and so subtle. And so I applaud you for attempting to sustain a culture of conversation, which in a world of sound bites is so difficult these days.
Well, I'm really interested what you said about the linguistic field, too, because I think human beings, you know, when we start to lose something, we take it for granted, and then all of a sudden we go, oops, we don't want to lose this. And I think that language is like that, in that, you know, there are now 7,000 something languages being spoken around the world, but over 3,000 of them have under 100 speakers in these small indigenous tribal languages, and they're in huge danger of just falling silent forever.
Wow, just so say that once again. There are 3,000?
3,000 languages that have only a couple hundred speakers remaining. And so in the next 50 years, you know, almost half of our language can fall silent. And English is becoming, you know, the huge global language, which in some ways is very helpful in terms of our being able to understand the stories of other people far away from where we grew up. But it also is having a tremendous cultural toll on all that nuance that you were talking about. So I'm glad to know that there are a lot of people that want to study this at this time. And I think the culture of conversation is also one of those things that's rising up in reaction to the soundbite, cyberspace, text messaging, what we're doing to language that is taking a lot of its art out.
I agree completely. I mean, there's just about 1,000 things coming to my mind at the moment, especially regarding technology. And a friend and I had lunch yesterday, and he was joking about how he has a new laptop and he's not used to the laptop culture because, he forgot his laptop and he thinks he's just can't handle having it not with him at every moment. And I said, you know, I forgot my cell phone at home today. And I thought, wow, should I go home to get my cell phone?
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, yeah. And, you know, at Dietrich's now you can sit and there's free internet wireless. And so you can sit and people sit and text message and with there's their little picture of
mm-hmm.
themselves and
mm-hmm.
there's somebody right next to them that they're not talking to. And they're talking, or they're, you know, talking online, texting.
Right.
And we've also, because of this quickness that we have, this ability to speak to people, I think we've lost the past culture of letter writing. So we're not as articulate. And instead we use these little smiley faces.
Yeah.
We've got to just put a smiley face on the end of everything rather than thinking through and artfully expressing ourselves
right.
through language. So how can we fix this?
Well, I hope that we'll bring back story because, I mean, the subtitle of the book is The Power and Practice of Story. And I think there are three very important words in that subtitle. One is making sense. And that story is how we organize what's happening to us. So the first thing, something happens, and the first thing we have the impulse to do is make a story out of it. And we do that because we need to understand it ourselves, and we need to communicate it. Like yesterday, I was on my way to work, and a big SUV pulled over in my lane on a two-lane road. And, you know, I'm kind of like saying my prayers and being in this little, you know, nice spiritual space driving to work. I look up, and there's this wonko car in my lane at about 50 miles an hour. Well, I swerved, and he swerved, and we got away from each other. But I was pretty shaken, you know. I had to have a few little tears. And immediately I said, I need to tell somebody this so that I don't carry it inside me all day as attention. And so I walked into my workplace, and I looked around for the friendliest face that I could find. And, you know, someone looked up and said, hi, how are you? And I said, glad to be here. And I told them this little sound, you know, it is a sound bite. It's just a little tiny story. But the difference between almost got hit and saying, I looked up, there was the guy, you know, our eyes met, we both took care of our vehicles, and then I cried, and then here's how I feel now, is deeper gratitude to have made it alive to work. That's a story, because it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It creates scene, characters, what happened, and what we learned. And my huge concern about this shortening everything down to text messages is we don't take time to do that. And when we don't make that little narrative connection, then we don't learn.
Yes, and it's so unfortunate, I think, that to like you said, thank you for saying that you recognized you needed to tell someone. Mm-hmm. And you knew that to do that, you needed to find a friendly face.
Mm-hmm.
and where you felt safe and you could connect with that person. And that the reason is that we need to make meaning. And this is a human need.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that should be pushed away, which I think I notice, at least in my life, occasionally when I start to maybe tell a story, because a friend of mine used to joke, it's not about the actual story, the meaning of the story with Sarah. It's about just telling it. About the travel of telling that story, that people's eyes tend to glaze over, like, what is the point of this? Why? What is this information going to get me? How is listening to someone else's issue going to give me anything, that we're so used to compartmentalizing issues and information,
right,
that if it's not of immediate value that we can see, because we're such a self-interest, individualistic society at this point, at least here, I think. I think it's just very, you have a lot of valor in acknowledging that this is a human need and that stories are how we connect with each other.
Well, so even when you're in this fast pace, I keep saying we run over the moment with our momentum. And when we run over those moments with the momentum, we become less and less aware of ourselves. And that story is what sets our path. The story we tell ourselves about who we are and what we're capable of and what we want and how we're going to go get it, all that requires full sentences and complete thought. And when we don't take the time to tell ourselves or be conscious of the story we're telling ourselves, what happens is we become malleable to these impulse images, you know, to advertising, to political slogans, to all these things. We go, oh, yeah. Well, and when I hear somebody go, oh, yeah, he's right, I go, how do you know? Slow down and tell me how you came to that position.
So give an example of that, if you would, when you hear somebody say, like, they're just regurgitating some prior information from something they read or something they saw, or they just agree because it feels good, it sounds right. And
yeah.
So you questioning them and that, how do you know?
So what I do is I don't get judgmental in my reaction. I just get very curious. And so you know, you'll see a headline or somebody's made a snap decision. It's in the news all the time. You know, somebody makes a very quick decision and then they sell it. And or even the debate going on right now about Iraq, you know, the way that debate, which is a very complex debate, is being presented us is still in this, are you for the president or against the president? And so you get people going, well, he's our president and we should. And I go, well, that's great. Yes, he is our president. And I want you to talk to me about why you think we should stay the course here.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find is a lot of times people can't, because they haven't thought about it. They haven't put it into some kind of, this makes sense to me. All they've got is that first level of media, you know, selling you an idea, selling you this or that.
Or and framing it. They're,
absolutely.
And this slogan or phrase, perception management.
Yes.
This is so,
what is that?
Well, it's just in the language of those two words, perception management.
Yeah, no kidding. And, you know, I mean, now they're probably offering courses on perception management as part of the linguistics program, you know, because shadow has this huge, and there's a huge shadow side to story, because we are, through our technology, reframing and managing the story. But this book calls us back to the classical moments of storytelling. And what concerns me about what we're doing in the modern world with our pace is that 98% of what we know about how to be a human being that we have learned over thousands of years has been passed along through story, through teaching stories. Everything from why you shouldn't touch a hot burner when you're a little two-year-old kid to very sophisticated views of the cosmos, you know? So it's science has used story and parents have used story. And our brains are wired to remember through narrative. And we can't undo that in 50 years of Blackberries and laptops. You know?
Well, that's so true. Even the word history has story in it.
Yeah.
And, I know what I was going to say is that when you talk about narrative, that's how we remember things is so true. I learned how to remember people's names, and someone taught me this, and it's always worked, is that because we only remember things via association or if we have an emotion attached to it. So when we meet people, we don't normally have an emotion towards them. So one way is to say a true sentence, as you indicated earlier, we need sentences, complete sentences that is true about that person in our head. We'll have a tiny, tiny story that causes us to reflect and remember. And so I appreciate you reaffirming the value of narrative and the value of story. And I want to talk we have about 6 or 7 minutes about some of the actual information in your book.
Great.
One that I just opened your book to a random page, and what I am reading is titled, the title here is Revisioning the Story, and you talk about the fairy tale, The Emperor's New Clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would, just talk what you talk about here in the book.
Is that chapter 6 you're looking at or chapter 8?
It's page 175, and it's I don't know what chapter. It says, one of the most empowering aspects of how story functions in organizations.
That's what I thought that chapter was. So there's quite a scope to this book. I start off talking about how my family was and how I came from a family in which one side was talkers and one side was not. And then I talk about how we build our self-story and that we really begin our lives by, like I said a minute ago, who we say we are. And then I go out into the world and I look at historical moments and how the story has played out in various historical moments. And the chapter you're looking at is about the story of organizations, and that when we drive to work in the morning, we park our car and we go in and we start chatting around the coffee pot and so forth. What we don't often think about is the fact that we're living inside the story of the organization, and that the organization has its own narrative. Because they do think in full sentences. They think about, you know, how to build profit, how to build market share, et cetera. And they're pushing forward from beginning to middle to end. You know, they're going in that direction. And all the people who work in an organization are contributing or not contributing to that story. And so that chapter is really taking a look at how you can become conscious of the story in the organization and decide to influence it. And that one group of people that I worked with, they had a very complex project, and they thought, oh, my gosh, how can we do this? I don't know how to do this. I said, well, let's do it as a fairy tale first. And so we said, you know, who's in fairy tales? Well, you know, there's the king. And so they said, oh, that's the boss, you know. And then there's, you know, there's the good prince, and there's the bad prince, and there's the dragon. And everybody took roles, and they wrote out the story, the fairy tale of how they were going to do this project. And they ended up coming up with, in myth, in this game, the basis for a design to do the work. And they had so much fun with it. And when they hit really hard moments, they knew what to do. And they could just play with each other. And somebody would go, well, there's the dragon coming in, instead of, why do you do this? You know how we get on each other's nerves. You always stop this. You always this. You always that. Instead, the man would just say, well, I'm being the dragon right now because I think we need to slow down.
Mm.
And so story can release incredible creativity in us.
Well,
but the other thing I want to say here is that, you know, I come out of this journal writing background, and that one of the profound things that you can do is just practice telling your story to yourself. Like, take 10 minutes in the morning, set a kitchen timer, and either type or handwrite, and just write a page that begins, "Once upon a time," or "It was a bright and sunny day," or "It was a dark and stormy night," or "The little princess ran out of the woods," or, you know, just anything, and just go into your story and play around with it, and it will have incredible impact on your ability to see yourself in the context of the big story of your life.
Well, that was what I was going to ask next, because since you mentioned that, and for some reason, I guess this week being finals week at UCI, it's such a stressful time for students, and we're spending so much time focused in one area or many areas, depending. And for myself, I yesterday took a break before a final, and instead of, you know, cramming those last few facts into my head, I just sat there and contemplated kind of my own story, as you said, and I find it very difficult. I think it's difficult to do, but it's a skill that is important to be able to articulate for many reasons, for the future, for career paths, or different projects that we want to pursue. We need to be able to explain to others in an articulate fashion what our story is, because even people can start off conversation these days. So what's your story?
Yeah, that's great. But
how do you do that? Because it's, you know, it's evolving, it's dynamic, it's ever changing, and we can look at ourselves differently, and it's very hard to step out of ourselves and then look from an objective point of view.
Well, the leaders, as you go out of college, the leaders of your generation are going to be those who have been able to hang on to the skill of story, because those are the people who will step into leadership positions in workplaces, because they know how to rally people around and help them talk to each other, listen to each other. I've worked with graduate business students and their professors, and the students go, "Well, like, why do we need to talk to people? You just tell them what to do." And I said, you know, as people mature, they are not going to take this from you, and they're especially not going to take it from a 23-year-old MBA walking in to a company full of 40-year-olds who just says, "I don't have to talk to you. I don't care who you are. Just do what I say." That's, you know, there's going to be huge rebellion going on here. If you want to manage people, you need to know their story. And my little company does so much work in various kinds of organizations in which huge conflict has risen up. And what I say is, so what's the story here? And we go back, we figure out the story, and it's the story that brings us together. And even somebody, you know, whether it's in your dorm room or at your workplace, or if you know their story, suddenly their behavior, it doesn't get at you in the same way, or you understand it.
It makes sense.
It makes sense, and it also allows, I mean, people are moving into, you know, highly polarized situations right now in which, you know, you're supposed to define yourself by your religion or, you know, your political beliefs or whatever, and, you know, that doesn't make community. Mm-mm. It's story that makes community. And I once walked into a place where people were really torn apart over race and gender issues, and so I said, "Here we're going to take 10 minutes."
Well, Christina,
you haven't got 10 minutes.
No, I'm going to have you back and focus more on this issue, because I think it's very relevant. As you said, the leaders of this generation need to be able to tell their story and a story and recognize it. Thank you for joining me on the show this
morning.
Well,
get through your finals.
Okay.
And then we'll talk again.
Okay. Take care.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Piece by Piece. I'm Sarah Pauley, and I'll be back next Friday, same time, 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Thank you for joining me this morning. You're listening to KUCI in Irvine, 88.9 FM, and also streaming live on the web at www.kuci.org.